You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. The Minnesota legislature recently passed a medical marijuana bill, making it the 22nd state to do so. Governor Mark Dayton is expected to sign it into law in a few days. That being said, the law has its limits. In order to qualify for medical marijuana, a patient must have one of nine conditions: cancer, accompanied with severe nausea or pain, HIV or AIDS, Tourette's, glaucoma, ALS, seizures, severe muscle spasms, Crohn's disease, or a terminal illness. Marijuana can only be consumed in liquid, oil, or pill form. Patients cannot use the cannabis flowers or leaves, and smoking is not allowed. There are other restrictions as to who is able to get their hands on medical marijuana, but first and foremost, a patient must be a Minnesota resident. That means a Wisconsin patient receiving care in, say, Winona, will not be able to legally access medical marijuana. The patients who can will have to annually enroll in a state-run medical cannabis registry program. In order to do so, they'll have to work with their healthcare practitioners. For people living and working on the Minnesota border, that's where things start to get fuzzy. The practitioners won't be prescribing medical marijuana. Under the law, Minnesota licensed doctors, physician assistants, and advanced practice registered nurses can sign off on a patient's record and certify that the patient does have a condition that qualifies them for medical marijuana. The practitioner then has to submit updated reports on the patient's health. So what does this mean for healthcare providers working in Minnesota and Wisconsin? Gunderson Health System and Mayo Clinic Health System have employees who work across the border. Spokespeople from both hospitals say they don't know how the new law will work for their employees, and they're still working out the details. Robert Kopecky is the Deputy Director of State Policies for the Marijuana Policy Project. He gives his thoughts on how that could work out on the border.
It's not something that was addressed on either floor, as far as I know. The letter of the what will hopefully soon be law, and what is currently session law, I guess, and it would read to me that either the healthcare professional, whether that's a doctor or a PA or an advanced practice nurse, would just have to hold the Minnesota license. I don't think there's any requirement that they practice in the state, but that they're licensed to do so. Like you correctly pointed out, there are probably plenty of physicians and nurses on the Wisconsin side of the border that Minnesota patients go to. So I suppose so long as the patient has a condition that qualifies under the law and the healthcare provider agrees to the other provisions that are placed upon healthcare providers that wish their patients to use medical marijuana, then they should be allowed to do so.
When you see this happening in other states, do doctors or nurses or the physician's assistants, do they have to go through special training? I'm assuming some of them are educating themselves about prescribing medical marijuana?
Yeah, as far as I know, the states that are currently operating workable medical marijuana laws, there's never any extra requirements placed upon the healthcare providers who are able to recommend medical marijuana to their patients, other than they have the power to prescribe controlled substances as well. This new observational study that was kind of thrown into the bill, I'm not sure it's something that's been done or tried before. It's an interesting requirement because it requires a lot of extra work on the healthcare provider's side, and these are typically individuals who are overworked as it is. So I've got some serious reservations about including that.
Okay, sure.
Not quite as onerous as some other suggestions in other states, but none of those are law or will be law. So.
And it's kind of interesting when you look at the insurance aspect of that and the complications surrounding that, too.
Well, sure. There's a concern that the extra patient visits that are just going to be to, check up on how patients are responding to treatment via medical marijuana or via medical cannabis, that those will drive up costs and out-of-pocket costs to the patient themselves or their parents or their caregivers, because it's not covered by insurance because it is federally controlled Schedule I.
I know it's kind of early in the game, but within the law in Minnesota, it would create two manufacturing facilities, and each of those facilities would have four dispensaries each. is the hope that there would be dispensaries scattered across the state, I guess, from your organization's perspective?
Yeah, that's absolutely the hope, is that these points of access will be distributed geographically across. I mean, Minnesota is, you know, unlike a state like Rhode Island that has three dispensaries, you know, but is quite geographically small. Minnesota is much bigger than that, and there needs to be, you know, access throughout. We're talking about trying to get medicine to people who are incredibly ill, many of whom have, you know, issues getting out of bed, let alone traveling hours at a time just to pick up or have access to their medicine their doctor thinks is best for them. So that's the idea behind that. At first, there was only one manufacturer, and that was pretty unacceptable.
And going back to the Minnesota law, you know, while some were glad that at least the legislature made it this far, there were some who still criticized and saying that the law didn't go far enough. What's MPP's stance on the Minnesota law? And maybe when you look towards the future, what steps do you hope that the legislature would take?
We're right along with those who are happy that the legislature passed it. We're happy that the governor has stated that he's going to sign it. We find the final content of the bill to be overly restrictive. We don't think that it's going to end up helping as many people as a good, regulated, and responsible medical marijuana program like originally introduced into the legislature could have. I think the fiscal note for the bill that was sent to the governor estimated that it's going to help about 5,000 patients. The one that was originally introduced by Senator Scott Dibble and Representative Carly Moline would have protected roughly, I think they estimated, about 35,000 patients. There were conditions that were left out of the final bill that have been shown to respond favorably and without, you know, terrible side effects to the use of medical marijuana. Conditions like extreme or debilitating nausea was left out, unless that's tied to like cancer treatment. But for instance, there's a little boy in Minnesota who's got a mitochondrial disease, and it leads to just incredible nausea where he's consistently vomiting and can barely keep anything down. Now, he's not going to be covered by this law, so he's left out. You know, we're committed to continuing to work with the advocates on the ground and with the patients on the ground to see to it that, you know, the commissioner has all the information that he needs and that lawmakers continue to get all the information they need to not only approve more conditions that, you know, have been shown to respond well to medical use of marijuana, but also to try to do away with some of the more onerous restrictions on providers and patients for getting the access in the first place.
And what about the idea that Minnesota has flat out banned smoking medical marijuana, and it can't be consumed in its flower form, but you can consume it in oil, pill, liquid, and I guess they consider vapor not smoking, but just moving beyond those issues too and the difference that those could make?
Those were certainly unnecessary provisions. We definitely disagree with prohibiting patients from using whole plant marijuana flowers. They're requiring the vaporization of oils if someone wants to administer medical marijuana via inhalation is requiring these patients, who that's the best route of administration, to use products that are typically much stronger than and much, much more intoxicating than using whole plant natural marijuana flowers would be. And that's a problem because not only is it, you know, the problem of too much intoxication on your medication, but it makes it more difficult for patients to titrate their doses. In states that allow patients to either smoke or vaporize whole plant marijuana, they can, you know, take one puff off of a vaporizer or off of a little pipe or something like that and continue as necessary, but not to the point of, you know, being extremely groggy or intoxicated. So that's a big problem. The idea of prohibiting smoking, I think, was just unnecessary. It's an unnecessary intrusion into doctor-patient relationship. While clearly smoking anything isn't probably ideal, if a patient is suffering from late-stage, you know, cancer and going and has extreme pain or nausea due to chemotherapy, if their doctor thinks that it's the quickest and easiest way for them to smoke a little bit of medical marijuana or medical cannabis, I think that's probably something that should be allowed to happen. It's not. It's a far safer substance than many of these end of life, especially the end of life treatment you know, options that are available out there.
I read some quotes from Minnesota lawmakers who said, you know, with this passage, it's going to increase drug use and whatnot. How does the organization respond to comments like that made by lawmakers?
Well, I think they're uninformed. I think it's an easy accusation to throw out there in an effort to kind of scare people. I mean, it's nothing more than just fear-mongering and 21st century reefer madness. All of the studies that have been done to look at whether or not passage of medical marijuana laws lead to increase in, like, youth use, for instance, have shown that they do not. Opponents like to point to usage rates in states with medical marijuana versus those in states without. But that's just the wrong data to look at. Everyone who's looked at usage rates before and after a state has passed medical marijuana, they've never shown there's been an increase in youth use. And in fact, in many states, there's been a decrease in youth use after a medical marijuana law has been passed. So I vehemently disagree with that. And I also think the studies that have been done back me up on that as well.
Robert Capecchi is the Deputy Director of State Policies for the Marijuana Policy Project. We're talking about medical marijuana in Minnesota and Wisconsin. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Wisconsin lawmakers passed their own medical marijuana bill this session, although it's much more limited. Under the new law, people suffering from seizures would be exempt from criminal penalties if they possess cannabidiol. That's a marijuana extract low in psychoactive effects. Although the new law allows certain people to possess it, accessing cannabidiol legally in Wisconsin is complicated. Pharmacies and physicians need federal and state approval in order to dispense it. The Pharmacy Society of Wisconsin is not currently aware of any institutions seeking the approval to carry cannabidiol. According to the Marijuana Policy Project, patients seeking the drug would have to travel to Michigan, Oregon, or Nevada to obtain it legally. Deputy Director of State Policies, Robert Capecchi, says Wisconsin patients will not be able to access cannabidiol in Minnesota.
Not legally. They would have a very difficult time accessing it really anywhere. That's one of the reasons why we don't consider these cannabidiol laws that are being enacted. I mean, Wisconsin's not the only state that has done this. Utah has enacted one. Florida is on the path to enacting a similar program, as is Iowa. But, you know, none of them really envision how patients are going to access this in an easy way. So it's going to be a huge problem. We're hopeful that some people will be helped by these cannabidiol laws, but it's also encouraging that the Wisconsin legislature and Governor Walker have recognized that there's therapeutic benefits found within marijuana. And, you know, I encourage both the Wisconsin legislature and the governor to look more closely at this and expand upon their law in future sessions.
So while that law is restrictive, do you see it as a good first step towards even, you know, full-blown medical marijuana legalization in Wisconsin?
It's tough to say because unlike the step that Minnesota took, I really have my doubts that it's going to end up helping anybody. So, I mean, it could work in that, you know, patients down the road see this as just feigned compassion, and they come back at the legislature that much more fired up and ready to push for a bill that's actually going to get them, you know, some access. It's not, you know, they don't have to violate laws to get. I mean, that's the whole idea of passing a medical marijuana law, is to get legal access, at least state legal access, to these terribly ill individuals. And as these CBD cannabidiol laws are being written and signed into law, it's not going to happen, unfortunately, at least in my opinion.
And under the Wisconsin law, too, if a pharmacy wants to carry cannabidiol, it has to seek FDA approval. But essentially, it's not necessarily easy for a pharmacy to get FDA approval to carry cannabidiol. I think there are still some strings attached to that issue.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's still considered a Schedule I substance. So from my understanding, it would be very difficult for a pharmacy to receive that approval without marijuana or, I suppose, cannabidiol being rescheduled out of the restrictive Schedule I. Otherwise, you know, the Schedule I substances cannot be dispensed by pharmacies, by licensed pharmacists, without fear of losing their license.
Getting that federal change, I'm sure, would be quite the uphill battle.
Oh, yeah. There's been plenty of people working on it for years and years and years, and we're still working on it. But, you know, it's just the glacial pace that the federal government moves at lately. You know, that's what we're dealing with. So which is one of the reasons why MPP, at least, you know, does a lot of our work and focuses most of our efforts on the state level, because there's opportunity to actually make change on the state level, especially as it relates to the criminal laws of those states.
Robert Capecchi is the Deputy Director of State Policies for the Marijuana Policy Project. Today, we're talking about medical marijuana in Wisconsin and Minnesota. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Since the medical marijuana laws are so new in Wisconsin and Minnesota, there are a lot of kinks to work out legally. I talked about this with Manny Munson-Regala. He's Assistant Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Health. Munson-Regala says balancing the state and federal laws on marijuana is complicated, and figuring out the rules across the borders of Minnesota and Wisconsin is complex.
Because of the border and the intrastate aspect, federal law tends to have some implications on how this works. So if you're a doc, your biggest concern, I would think, is going to be what does federal law think about your behavior in a place where federal law still says this thing is still illegal. And that's where it gets even trickier. In Minnesota, the newly passed Therapeutic Cannabis Act doesn't actually let a doctor or require a doctor to recommend that marijuana cannabis is good for you or that it would be helpful for your condition. What it does, it says you certify that you have one of the 9 conditions. And then the patient goes to the manufacturer with that certification and get their medication from a pharmacist retained by the manufacturer.
I mean, is it just a doctor's note that they have to present?
That's part of the rulemaking we have to engage in as to the level of specificity that we're going to need. The other part about this that is different than Minnesota than other medical cannabis programs is by enrolling in our program, you as a patient agree, and you need sort of your doctor's agreement to facilitate this, to share with us clinical data so we can understand did what you get actually help you at what dosage levels or were there any sort of side effects. So what we hope to do is we hope to see right now there's a lot of anecdotal data about, okay, take this strain for this condition.
Right.
We want to be able to provide patients with a lot more specificity around this particular composition of cannabis with this ratio of THC to CBD is what you need versus for this condition. So let's use probably the one that you're maybe most familiar with as sort of being what has driven interest in this lately is the epilepsy for kids.
Sure, sure.
So the strains they're taking that work for kids are, bluntly, they're not strains that get you high because they have low THC content.
The cannabidiol.
Right, but they're very high in CBD, in the cannabidiol. And the CBD is where there's a lot of interest, particularly from the provider community, because there are some interesting components in the CBD, anti-inflammatory components, that may be of value for the medicine piece. So I think what we're going to have out of the Minnesota approach to doing this is better information to help inform patient choices.
I never thought about sort of that fine line between doctors needing to watch out for, just because of federal regulations. But also, obviously, they have to have that conversation with their patients. Like if a patient says, you know, I'm going to approach the state and sign up for this program, can the doctor even say anything?
I think the doctor will have to make a decision based on his or her sort of ethical constraints. I suspect that those are going to be sort of the sort of follow-up guidance we're going to see from, you know, the Board of Medicine, right? And all of the sort of, there are immunity provisions in our law for discipline, but they may have some kind of practice standards or they may have some other observations about how you want to, you know, practice medicine in this space. We are in a very tricky space where we're trying to do under state law, which is what is forbidden under federal law, right?
Right.
And that has implications on so many levels for how you do this from an implementation and pragmatic standpoint. By way of contrast, I'll share this with you. You know, the country of Israel certifies doctors to prescribe cannabis. So they have, I think, 21 certified or licensed cannabis specialists. So you as a general practitioner make a referral of your patient to one of these docs who knows the literature, knows the evidence, knows what works, and they're in a better position to have that conversation. Right now, you've got docs who, rightly so, are very nervous about providing recommendations on something that they have little understanding and knowledge about, and particularly of variable consistency and quality, which is part of the reason that our bill, our law, is very focused on trying to ensure a predictable product for the patients, right? So when you buy a product, you want to be sure it has the composition and ingredient list that it's labeled for. By way of illustration, I know that in Colorado, some of the edibles that have been marketed out there, even though they're labeled for X percent of THC, have varied in ranges. And I think that was a study done by the Denver Post. They did some of their own lab analysis. A lot of our goal is to be sure consumers get the product that they think they're paying for, and that we can develop data from their experiences to help inform future consumers or even help them with sort of their, you know, because you're getting a month worth of product at a time. That's the way our law works. You may conclude that the strain you got last time is not the right strain for you, but we would need the data to be able to help you with the determination.
It is quite interesting to think about just the research and the education that a lot of doctors will have to go through regarding this.
Right, and there may be docs that just refuse, they're not required to participate in this program. There may be docs that just refuse to participate, right? Let's assume you're a doc in a that has a pain medication agreement with a patient. You know, you're treating them for severe pain. You're prescribing them Oxy, for example, right? Part of your pain medication agreement might be you can't take any illicit drugs because that has implications for sort of your understanding of toxicity and understanding of sort of the patient experience. Those are the kind of complicating and I think interesting conversations that docs and patients and in our state APRNs and physician's assistants, because they can also certify conditions, are going to be having.
Going back to the border issue, it does make me wonder if doctors are just going to be extra careful when it comes to this, and you know, if there is a doctor who's licensed in Minnesota and Wisconsin, they may work out of a Minnesota clinic, if they're more likely to potentially work out of those clinics versus handling this via a La Crosse office.
In addition to federal law, you'd probably want to be sure that if you're prescribing at the Gunderson Clinic in downtown La Crosse, you know, so not prescribing, that you're writing a certification, that you don't run afoul of Wisconsin law, right?
Right.
Because Wisconsin law may apply to your allowing a patient to participate in a program. I think if I were a doc, I'd feel a lot safer about driving over to La Crescent or wherever the satellite location is and deciding, you know, here in this state, there is protection for my behavior.
Manny, at this point in time, is there anything else you want to talk about regarding the new law and maybe how it relates to some of the border institutions?
I think the border issue is one that we're going to have to look at, particularly with other states. I know it's been a source of I wouldn't say tension necessarily, but it's been a concern with Nebraska and Colorado. I think in some respects, our structure of our bill makes things a lot easier or potentially addresses some of the concerns because we're not going to we're not going to distribute leaf. What patients are going to get here is going to look like medicine. It will be a pill. It will be an oil. It'll be a refined product. It won't be, you know, smokable bud. You see what I'm saying?
Right, right.
So if you're law enforcement, you'll feel much better that this is pursuant to a regulated and legitimate source versus someone holding a baggie and you have no idea about the provenance of, you know, that stuff. So I think that's one advantage I would argue for our approach over some of the other approaches in other states, that from a diversion and legal versus illegal perspective, the form that we're approaching will make that task easier. Now, from a public health perspective, we also like the fact that it's not about smoking, because you can imagine public health folks aren't big fans of smoking anything, whether it's cannabis or tobacco or any other sort of burning product.
Manny Monson-Ragala is Assistant Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Health. We were talking about medical marijuana. You're listening to Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, I'm Maureen McCollum. Coming up next, a UW-La Crosse professor talks about a book he worked on that delves into how pop culture uses traditional political theory. To hear audio archives of today's show, visit our website at wpr.org/newsmakers. For updates on future shows, links to our archives, and more, like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Maureen McCollum. Just in time for summer's reading list and the fall's election cycle is a book about how popular culture, so movies, books, and TV shows, relate to political theory. UW-La Crosse Assistant Professor of Political Science, Tim Dale, helped edit the book and wrote a chapter on The Simpsons, which is where the book, Homer Simpson Ponders Politics, takes its name. Wisconsin Public Radio's John Davis asked Dale why it's important to examine the politics behind pop culture.
Well, not everyone thinks pop culture is important, and actually my chapter in the Homer Simpson Marches on Washington, I have the first chapter in that book, and it's directed at the people who argue that pop culture shouldn't matter or it's a distraction. And the common thought is that popular culture distracts people from politics or moves people away from being politically active. They just turn on the TV and they stop paying attention to politics. But I don't think that that's true. In fact, I think that a lot of what we know about politics and understand about politics comes directly from popular culture. So one of the arguments that I use frequently to talk about this is that our images of presidential candidates come largely from Saturday Night Live characters of those candidates more than they do the candidates themselves. So our memory of George W. Bush or the first Bush or Bill Clinton or candidates like Al Gore, even John McCain and Barack Obama, during those campaigns, Saturday Night Live, an entertainment show, is framing the way that people understand the candidates. And by exaggerating mannerisms and tendencies, we actually kind of impressed on our cultural memory what those candidates were like. And I think that's a very obvious example of the way that popular culture can affect what people are doing in politics. So I think that's one of the ways that popular culture is important. The Homer Simpson Ponders Politics book gets a little bit more in depth. And in this book, we're talking about the philosophy behind certain texts in popular culture and how that is reflective of a politics. So, for example, there's a chapter in the book titled From John Wayne to John McClane, The Conservative Action Hero. And that chapter does a very nice job of showing the way in which cowboy movies and action hero movies have a politics to them. In those movies, in those plays or novels, the hero is required because the country has failed. The state has failed. The state is unable to protect people ultimately. And so the hero has to declare kind of a state of emergency in which the hero can operate as a hero. And that's actually reflective of the kind of politics we saw during the Bush administration, the war on terrorism, this argument that the state and its liberal protections don't always function to protect people from their greatest threats.
Does all good or successful pop culture contain some sort of a reference to political theory or political philosophy?
Not necessarily. I think there's probably quite a bit of popular culture out there. I'm thinking one of the things we've had a hard time finding a political connection to is reality television. That's very popular, but it's not necessarily kind of intentional in its politics. The question really isn't, is all popular culture doing that? But in what instances do we find it as a particularly good examples of popular culture doing this? One of the sources for a lot of people's information that's in popular culture that is a kind of blurring the lines between popular culture and media is shows like The Daily Show, where you have Jon Stewart delivering a fake news show, and yet it is directed not only at real information. People are more informed to watch The Daily Show than many other cable news outlets, but also providing some both satirical look but serious look at criticizing media, but also political candidates and representatives. So I think that's another example where people turn something on for entertainment, but they're getting more than entertainment, and it's contributing to a national dialogue about really important issues, even if it's done in a way that people find very entertaining.
You happen to write the chapter on The Simpsons in the book. You're probably a big fan of The Simpsons. Why do you think The Simpsons are a good pop culture vehicle to explain political theory?
Right. And in the case of The Simpsons, we have a lot of things going for it. One of them is I enjoyed watching The Simpsons for a very long time. That's just my personal reflection on it. But one of the things that The Simpsons has going for it most broadly is that it is the longest running show on television by leaps and bounds, more seasons of The Simpsons, more episodes of The Simpsons than any other, certainly animated show, any other half hour show. And in that time, The Simpsons started with some fairly crude humor, you know, Bart Simpson's the rebel and Homer's the disengaged father. Marge is a worrier, Lisa's the nerd. In the course of all of those episodes and as the seasons went on, The Simpsons started tackling really important issues of family and religion and politics. And so my chapter is looking at some of the ways in which The Simpsons reflects some classical themes in political philosophy. And one of them is the importance of the personality of the city, the community of people. One of my arguments in the chapter is that The Simpsons is about more than just the family, The Simpsons. It's about the town of Springfield. And as episodes have been created over the years, we see the town of Springfield containing several different elements, many different people who struggle with the learning that goes on as a part of a community. And it turns out in The Simpsons, the community is a really important place where people learn how to be good citizens. And so there are several episodes and examples where Lisa, the one who supposedly knows it all, has to learn something from other members of her community who she might have initially disrespected, but learned that members of the community all have something to contribute. So that's an example where The Simpsons is really rich with a lot of different philosophical and political messages.
The philosophy of Aristotle you touch on quite a bit in the chapter.
Right. My argument for those who are fans of philosophy is that The Simpsons is Aristotelian. It reflects Aristotle's politics. And this may be surprising. People think of Aristotle as a fairly conservative political philosopher. Of course, ancient Greece, so we're dating back 2,000 years. But one of the things that Aristotle emphasized was the importance of community for sustaining a society and how each member of a community plays a particular role. And one of the things we see in The Simpsons is that each member of the city of Springfield serves a certain function. And when they go outside of that function, that typically leads to the disorder of an episode. So there's an episode where it turns out that the principal's a fraud and Skinner is actually an imposter, and the town goes out of order because the principal's actually not the principal. And by the time the episode ends and we get all the humor and disorder that happens because of the plot developments, at the very end, the judge who is sentencing the actual principal Skinner to leave town because they don't want the real one, they want the imposter back. The judge also declares that no one will ever speak of this again. In that episode, we see that this community has to go back to normal at the end of every episode in order to have the next episode start again. And so that move from disorder back to order is reflective of some things we see in Aristotle.
I don't know if you know any of the producers or writers on the show or have had a chance to talk to them. But do you think they think about stuff like this when they're actually producing an episode of The Simpsons?
I think that they sometimes do. When people are writing shows like The Simpsons or really anything where they're trying to entertain people, they want to tap into some things that are meaningful. So it's not just about making people laugh. It's also about making people think. And if you can make people laugh and think at the same time, you're really doing something. I actually think back to All in the Family and Norman Lear, who is making the show All in the Family to be the hit show that is the highest rated show on television. But Lear says, I am making this show also to make people think. And so I think one of the points of this collection and our work in popular culture and politics is we're arguing that people don't have to make a choice. You don't have to make a choice between putting something into a "this is for entertainment" category or a "this is for teaching people about politics" category. In fact, for as long as people have been writing down words and telling each other stories, they've been doing both. So if we look at Shakespeare, Shakespeare is doing politics and entertaining people. Some people forget, certainly not Shakespeare scholars, that when Shakespeare wrote his plays, he was writing them for a general audience. He wanted sellout performances. He wanted people to laugh at them. He wanted people to get angry. He wanted people to be moved. But he was also writing them with some political purposes embedded in them, which is why they've stood the test of time. Our argument is that there are many things that are part of our cultural conversation today that are doing the exact same thing.
How would you describe the mayor of Springfield and how he relates to your current modern-day politicians?
Well, Mayor Quimby is the archetype of the corrupt politician who has his hands in many different pies. In fact, there's one time in which the Mensa members in an episode, the geniuses of the town, go up to call him on a particular code violation in the gazebos in the town park. And Quimby thinks he's being called out for his corruption. And so he actually jumps out the window with his escape plan and leaves the town, leaving the town to the geniuses to run for an episode. In many episodes, we see political figures not being portrayed in a very good light. And so the commentary on The Simpsons is a common commentary we see in a lot of popular culture, which is very negative toward politics. But even in that negativity, there are moments for redemption. So at the end of the episode, they call Quimby back. It turns out the geniuses aren't as genius as everyone thought. The town goes into disarray. It's actually Stephen Hawking who comes in and saves the town. But that is a good example where on the surface you see Mayor Quimby as the corrupt politician. But then when you get deeper into it, the town realizes that they need political leaders. And Quimby may, after all, be the best one that's available to them.
Entertainment and animation aside, Springfield is really representative of a common American city, isn't it?
Well, and that's why
wouldn't you say that?
Absolutely. And that's why the writers didn't want to identify it. Springfield is supposed to be all of our town. We're not supposed to see it as a place that's out somewhere else. We're not supposed to see it as this town is unlike any other I've seen. The town looks a lot like the towns that we live in. Now, granted, we don't have the same characters in our town, but we see that the town has the common components to all communities, and that's another way in which it reflects the philosophy of Aristotle, as I describe it in the book chapter.
So if Springfield is a common town with a common electorate, I assume, what does that say about the electorate of this country?
Well, again, I think The Simpsons presents a fairly complex picture. So there are many episodes in which the people are easily persuaded. A monorail salesman comes into town one day and with a brief, catchy monorail song convinces everyone they need to build a monorail, which is, of course, going to be a disaster. Barney is one of the monorail drivers. In one case, and this is actually reflective of many animated shows, take the position that the electorate of democracy isn't always the most useful place to make decisions or most productive place to make decisions. We see some of the same things going on in the South Park show and getting a lot of mileage out of a democracy being a bad place. The sophisticated view, though, and a little bit deeper, is that it turns out that this is still the best way to run a community. So even though you have these big disasters that happen because you can't always trust democracy, the community comes together and saves itself at the end. So even though the episode begins, in the case of the monorail, with the electorate being one that's easily persuadable and not particularly wise, the electorate, the community, comes back together at the end and still manages to save the town. And so I think that's the view of democracy that's more sophisticated. It's cynical, but it also ultimately believes that there is a good society that's to be had within a democracy.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio La Crosse. I'm John Davis. We are talking with UW La Crosse Assistant Political Science Professor Tim Dale. He's a co-author and co-editor of the book Homer Simpson Ponders Politics, Popular Culture as Political Theory. Aside from The Simpsons, what are some of your favorite pop cultural references and how they relate to politics examples? in this book?
Well, the conservative chapter is really interesting to me, and I think to think about things that we see as very typical forms of American popular culture, like the Western or the action hero, and how that's reflective of political philosophy. I think that that's really interesting. I also think that the chapter on the Lord of the Rings is interesting, and that also is reflective of what we're talking about with the Aristotle in The Simpsons. In the Lord of the Rings, we see the friendship between the characters developing, and that's also a very good chapter. The last chapter of the book may be one that is less about a popular culture text and more about our culture in general, and that's the one written by my co-editor, Joseph Foy. Broadly speaking, our culture has become hyper-mediated. Everyone is a reporter now. Everyone is on Twitter. Everyone is on Facebook. And what Dr. Foy talks about in that chapter and what explores is how this in some way is fulfilling the promise of liberal democracy. That is, we all are a participant in our society. But there's a criticism out there that's being made by very good sound reasoning and scholarship that says that the internet actually causes us to remove ourselves from politics, and what counts as political participation becomes less and less. And I think this is a really interesting question. As people become more in control of the messages that they receive, popular culture does not become as it becomes less monolithic than it's been. So it's not, aren't just getting one message all the time from one or two media outlets. We're going out and choosing. And so the questions proposed in that chapter have actually led to some of the questions that I'm asking now in terms of what the nature of popular culture is and is going to be in the 21st century, and how it is that people are taking a more active role in the culture that they're consuming, and what that's doing to our overall conversation in a democracy.
What is it doing?
Well, that's the question I'm asking right now in the work that I'm doing. I think we're seeing several negative aspects of it. One of them is that people tend to choose people that they agree with to talk to. And one of the cornerstones of democracy, and this is rooted in the political philosophy that's argued for democracy from a long time, we see some of the best arguments in James Madison's contribution to the Federalist Papers about the importance of a diverse and pluralistic society for a democracy. Also, John Stuart Mill's Marketplace of Ideas. One of the things that is a negative impact on those ideals is when people don't talk to people who are different from them any longer, and you're not having a cultural discourse that is working through differences. You're having these little echo chambers that are developing where people only talk to people who are like them, and that actually increases conflict in society. We no longer have to resolve conflict. We can have our own little ideas, and then we have bigger and bigger conflicts when it comes to our public debates because we've been so insulated. That's a negative element. But there are also positive elements. More people are informed today than have ever been, and more people are connected to political arguments. One of the things we've seen is a proliferation of interest groups. So if you have a passion, if you have a concern about something, it only takes you a few mouse clicks before you find other people who have like-minded things. I think that's good for democracy. People have more outlets for expressing themselves, and people are empowered more than they've been ever before. So an average citizen can go on Twitter and change our cultural conversation if they say the right thing and it gets picked up by the right person. That's the kind of thing that I think is a promise of that kind of democracy over the internet. But there are also those pitfalls. And so that's, I think, kind of the future of thinking about popular culture and democracy is to think about these kinds of cultural developments.
Back to that negative aspect of people talking with like-minded people, is there anything from history that shows where we may be headed with that?
One of the positives of this is that we really haven't had a time in history before where everyday people have been empowered to the level that they've been. So where we've seen this kind of be as negative examples in history is when you have an aristocratic class or a ruling class that doesn't have to listen to people. Mm-hmm. And when that happens, then that's where, you know, tyranny comes from. And so we haven't had a time in history where everyday people have had as much power as they've had. And it really is unprecedented then that those people can get together with people who are exactly like them and not talk to anybody else. So we have seen some examples in history where people who are in charge haven't listened to people who are out of power. Mm. But it really is unprecedented, I think, raising really interesting questions about where American democracy could go potentially as a positive thing or could go negatively is when people are empowered, what do they do with that power?
I knew you made a reference before about the fact that there are some people who dismiss popular culture in society, but I think the vast majority are consumers of it. They read books, they watch movies or TV. Do most people view popular culture when they're viewing it for entertainment value, or do they look at the politics behind it? And I assume that's what this book is designed to make people think about. But
right. Well, definitely people view it much more for entertainment purposes. And in fact, I really doubt that anyone other than maybe the contributors to my book turn on the TV to consume political messages in things that they enjoy. But I think that part of the reasoning behind this work that we're doing and the writers of these chapters and this collection are intending is for people to think a little bit more about the political messages in the popular culture that they're consuming. So when we turn on 24, which is now back on television, and it's about the war on terror. It's about how you go after criminals. It's about how you persecute a war. And there are messages in 24 about either validating or being contrary to foreign policy opinions and strategies that we have debates about. And so those the people who make shows like 24 are intending to contribute to the cultural conversation even as they are making popular culture. Another example that people might be even more familiar with is the Star Wars episodes 1, 2, and 3 that Lucas went back to and made starting about a decade ago. And in these films, Lucas is making them during the Bush administration. And there are some key moments where I would imagine many viewers couldn't help but see the political messages in them. So there is a scene where the emperor is elected emperor and the entire Senate is applauding. And Queen Amidala says, "This is how freedom dies," with a round of applause. And this is Lucas having a message within Star Wars, which is, you know, people don't go to Star Wars to get a political message. But this is a really good example of where when people are consuming something for entertainment value, it's also helpful to see how it is that the person who produced this is communicating political messages.
I know a lot of people, or some people, we just talked about this, I think pop culture has been a detriment, especially since the beginning of the 60s. Does that argument relate to the book at all, that pop culture has somehow denigrated society or led to its decline?
It might. And actually, I think debates about that culture wars argument actually happens in popular culture. So there are arguments in popular culture that are responding to that debate. And so it's not really popular culture. The messages in popular culture aren't necessarily conservative or liberal. We're getting a whole range of messages. And one of the things that I think we find is that popular culture tends to be more libertarian. That is, it is open to a free – wants a free exchange of ideas, tends to be permissive. And so I think there are certainly some who think that popular culture is bad because it promotes a kind of permissive society. There's actually several people who are on the political left, leftist intellectuals, who also criticize popular culture with the argument that it allows people to escape from their political responsibility, that it is an irresponsible form of politics because democracy requires activism. So these people want political activism and don't find political activism on the internet, don't find political activism in popular culture. So there are some who criticize, for example, U2 having a concert to promote awareness of the plight of people in Africa, that that criticism is that that is an irresponsible use because it allows people to go to a concert and then feel like they did something for their society. So there is a whole range of criticism of popular culture that popular culture or people who are critics of popular culture either have to respond to or find agreement with. And these are the kinds of things we talk about in the book.
Tim, who is this book intended for?
The book is intended for anyone who is interested in questions of popular culture who may want to know a little bit more about the politics within that popular culture. So people who are looking to learn a little bit more about political philosophy will find something in this book that will teach them about political philosophy. But primarily it will help people think about how it is that the popular culture texts that they're watching all the time or reading about or listening to in the form of music, how that in a deep and maybe subconscious way informs people's political thinking about things that are happening in society.
Tim Dale is an assistant professor of political science at UW-La Crosse and co-author and co-editor of the book Homer Simpson Ponders Politics, which looks at the relationship between political theory and pop culture. He was interviewed by Wisconsin Public Radio's John Davis. Thanks for listening to Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, I'm Maureen McCollum. Our production team includes John Gatto, Mary Meehan Stroob, and our senior news editor and producer, John Davis. If you missed part of today's show, you can find the audio archives at wpr.org/newsmakers. Our site also has archives of other recent editions of Newsmakers, and if you'd like to share comments or make a suggestion for future shows, you'll also find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers. For updates on future shows, links to our archives, and more, like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers.